completed deathless mindlessness is the path to death. The mindful do not die. The unmindful are like dead already. This was an utterance of the Buddha, the Dhammapada verses. And that kind of sums up what the real practice of Dhamma ultimately leads to. And that is essentially what the Eightfold Path is. The Eightfold Path, for those who might not be familiar with the Buddhist teachings, is the fourth of the Four Noble Truths. That is the path leading to the cessation of dukkha, or unsatisfactoriness, or suffering. So I want to speak, being this sort of closing talk, and after this weekend of meditation, everyone, you know, the big concern or question is, you know, how do we integrate meditation in daily life? How do we practice Dhamma in daily life? How do we relate all this to daily life? And that's, essentially what the practice of Dhamma is. Actually, the whole practice of the Eightfold Path is essentially a kind of meditation. It's mindfulness in daily life. And that mindfulness, is eventually cultivated to become a near constant state of mind. So we have an idea of, we want to, last night there was a question about going to Nibbana. And I mentioned, well, we don't really go to Nibbana. But let's have an idea, you want to go somewhere. Let's say in this case, to the end of suffering. Or if you wanted to drive anywhere in your car. You know, if you want to drive from Ottawa to Vancouver. Now you can say, well, I don't need a map, I know how to go. Just jump in the car, start driving north, you wind up in Yellowknife. Or if you drive east, you wind up in Quebec City or Newfoundland. So anyway, when you drive somewhere, it's you need to have a map. You need to know where you're going. You need to hopefully know where the best roads are. If you're in a hurry, you want to know where the quickest road is. If you're not in a hurry, you like to see the country roads, and you need to know where the scenic and the country roads are. So in the practice of Dhamma, we also sort of need to know where we're going. We need to have a road map. And the Eightfold Path is sort of our roadmap. Really, the Four Noble Truths, but the Eightfold Path being the actual way to practice, is a roadmap, which was mapped out by all the previous Buddhas who have traveled that way. And the first aspect of the Eightfold Path is the right understanding. It means if we're going to do something, anything, we have to have an understanding of what we're doing, what's involved. an understanding of what we're up against. And so the right understanding is the essential, the basic understanding of the Dhamma. And understanding is of three levels. The first is what we call the Suttamaya Panya, or the level of intellectual understanding. That means for most people the way we've learned Dhamma is through books or listening to lectures, especially Westerners in this country. That's the medium that most of us came into contact with the Dhamma. So we get an intellectual understanding. We read something like the Four Noble Truths. We read about, impermanence, suffering, no self. We learn about karma, rebirth. We learn about nirvana and these various aspects of the Dhamma. And it's mostly new to us, especially for Westerners. We read that and it says, wow, that's pretty neat. They don't teach us that in the schools. And certainly, the President of the United States doesn't teach us that. So, it's like we never heard these things before. It's not common understanding. So we get interested. But you might read a book or two, hear a talk or two, and kind of get initially interested, but then what happens? Then you kind of get caught back up in your ordinary, fast-paced life and hobbies and activities and kind of forget about it. Or it goes underground, at least for a while. So therefore, in order to deepen that interest and to continue that interest, the second level of understanding must follow, and that is the Chintamaya Panya, or the wisdom, the understanding that comes through reflection and contemplation, or continued thinking. So this is the second step of the Eightfold Path. You have your right understanding, you have your intellectual understanding, and you've got your Dhamma book in your back pocket. And now you're off to practice right thought, or right aspiration, or right intention. That's all the different translations of the word sama sankappo. Right thought is sufficient. So you start thinking about the Dhamma. And that has three levels. It means that the thought of renunciation. It doesn't mean thinking that now I have to become a monk or a nun. But it means renunciation means simplifying one's life, taking a stock of one's life and seeing how much clutter that we have in our life, our material possessions, even our mental baggage and other sort of things. All the kind of different hobbies and interests that we have that just take up our time. That we do because out of boredom or out of habit, but a lot of it doesn't have much real benefit. And it causes us lots of worry. The more possessions we have, the more we have to protect it, the more we have to keep it clean, and worry about getting stolen or our neighbors, our relatives coming over and wanting to borrow it and then bring it back in bad condition. All these sort of things. The more we have, the more that happens, right? And a lot of these things we think we really need, but actually becomes our burden. So part of right thought means, wouldn't it be nice if I didn't have all these things? I wouldn't be burdened with all that. So it means simplifying one's life, not only in the material possessions, but also just in your worries and thoughts about clinging to the past, even projecting about the future and so on. So the thought of renunciation, think about, lightening up, letting go of a lot of unnecessary baggage in our life. Then there's the thought of non-ill will. A lot of times we spend a lot of time developing ill will towards people who hurt us, thinking about them and, in negative ways and so on, wishing them, harm or so, or just negative thoughts. So that's also a kind of a poison to our mind. So the right thought means not thinking those thoughts. It means the thought of compassion, thinking thoughts of or loving kindness towards others instead of ill will. And then the next form of right thought is similar. It's non-cruelty, the thought of non-harming. Usually ill will leads to sort of thoughts of harming. So they kind of go hand in hand. And I mean, this is based on the understanding that all beings are seeking happiness. And if we have ill will towards others, we're going to attract ill will from others to us. According to the law of karma, if we harm others, we're just inviting harm to come back to ourselves through the law of karma. So cultivating thoughts of non-ill will and non-cruelty, non-harming to others. Essentially that involves the practice of loving kindness and compassion. So you can see that those three kinds of thought, the thought of giving up, and the thought of renunciation can be practiced through the practice of dana, the practice of giving, which is an integral form of, an integral aspect of Dhamma practice, dana, or giving, sharing with others, being generous, instead of hoarding things for yourself according to one's means. One shares with others, because that also opens up a lot of dark corners in our mind. And the selfishness is considered one of the most deepest poisons of our mind. Because of selfishness, all kinds of greed and anger and hatred arises. So, the right thought is cultivating those sorts of positive thoughts instead of those negative ones, and doing the sorts of actions even that promote those sort of thoughts. And then what is next? Okay, we're pertaining to thinking now, speech. The right speech is the third aspect of the Eightfold Path. Based on a right understanding, we understand that, we cause a lot of harm through this mouth. And there's a saying that each person is born with an axe in their mouth. That means we cut ourselves down by our tongue, and cut other people down by the tongue. This refers to the harsh types of speech, lying, slandering, backbiting, tail-bearing, belittling speech, harsh speech, vulgar speech, and also just what is called worldly talk or frivolous talk, gossip mongering, and so on. And, you know, trying to disunite people by saying, "Oh, so and so, you know, he said this about you and your family," you know, and trying to, you know, get people against each other, that sort of thing. Very common practice, and a lot of karma is created through that kind of speech. And speech can wound more than bullets or knives. Because a bullet wound may heal over a few weeks, but some ill-directed words at the right time can wound a person for a whole life. So right speech means abstaining from those four classifications of negative speech. That means lying, tail-bearing, or backbiting, slandering or harsh speech, and frivolous talk. And instead cultivating the wholesome speech. That means telling truthfulness, being devoted to truthfulness, and also using kind, gentle words, speaking in the right time, knowing when to speak, knowing when to keep silent. Using words that lift people up rather than putting them down. So, and then the next step of the Eightfold Path is the right action. And this essentially means living by the other precepts to avoid killing or harming living beings, to avoid the stealing, sexual misconduct, intoxicating the mind. Of course, right speech too, but that was already covered. In those five precepts, the breaking of those five precepts is the cause for probably 99.9% of all suffering in the whole universe, or at least on the human plane. And if you just check up, you'll see that that's true. So the Buddha highly praised trying to live by the five precepts. And even if a person just lived by the five precepts and didn't even perhaps, let's say, meditate or follow most of the other Eightfold Path, one could at least be assured of rebirth in heaven if one is interested in that. So that's how highly praised the precepts are. The catch is, you can't practice the precepts purely without meditating, because mindfulness is the most important ingredient, as we'll discuss. And then right livelihood. Somebody who's, you know, trying to follow the spiritual path, or at least wants to, realize their own peace of mind and to develop a more being at peace with oneself. And right livelihood also is important. That means earning a living that doesn't infringe too heavily on others, or earning a living that doesn't directly or indirectly break the other precepts, that break the five precepts. So if you have a job that's, let's say, raising animals to slaughter, or involved in some other forms of killing, harming people, that would be considered wrong livelihood. Or selling weapons and poisons and other things, selling things that other people would use to harm others with, or even to harm themselves with. Also, even in liquors and so on, intoxicating drinks and drugs, selling those things would be considered wrong livelihood because you're contributing to other people, destroying their minds and their life. So indirectly, you'd be sort of karmically involved in that. Or different forms of vice and so on. So these are livelihoods that should be avoided. Of course, there's many other livelihoods that also are not very beneficial to people. And there's other livelihoods that might be sort of beneficial, but they involve deceit and deception, fraud, cheating and lying to some extent. And this includes a lot of jobs. Even regular businesses. There's lots of cunning and competition goes on, lying. Sometimes you're forced to lie or cheat or fudge on your income tax reports and all kind of other things like that, even in normal businesses. Or people that know that they're selling junk, deceiving people, like a lot of these newfangled drugs or all these things that say, use this and you'll get this power and that power and, all kind of things, half of it, most of it's garbage. Or at least it's just a deception. It has hardly any benefit, but yet people are conned into thinking it does and they spend their hard-earned money for things and, anyway, people like the tobacco industry, knowing that tobacco is poison, but they go on selling it anyway, and trying to sell it to kids, and then denying it. All these sort of things, I'm not trying to blame people. I'm just pointing out common contemporary issues and seeing the extent of that sort of fraud and stuff that people are caught into. Because greed will make people do anything. Out of greed, people will, sell their mother. Anyway, so those three areas, right speech, right action, right livelihood, are the ones that are directly related to karma. Because we do those things with intentional actions, and the results of those things probably have their heaviest effects. And then there's the right effort. Essentially, that means the effort to practice. But it's a four kinds also. The effort to prevent unwholesome states from taking over your mind, and if they do come into your mind, the effort to abandon them, not to entertain them, but to abandon them. And then the effort to cultivate wholesome states of mind that we may not yet have, and the effort to maintain them and develop them and perfect them. You mean like, even the effort to meditate would be a wholesome state of mind. If you don't have meditation or haven't meditated, the effort to develop meditation, and then the effort to try to perfect it. And continuing it, developing it, even perfecting it. Actually, meditation is said to be the highest, the most positive mental state there is. Meditation, the highest positive karma, the most beneficial act that one can do in a whole lot, more than giving an ocean load of gems to the needy. The Buddha said that even developing the perception of impermanence, even for a finger snap, would be more beneficial than ocean full of gems, or any other things. We'll come back to this the right effort in a minute. And then right mindfulness, the seventh aspect of the Eightfold Path, essentially means cultivating mindfulness. The four foundations of mindfulness, but generally means being mindful of what you're doing in your life, knowing what sort of states of mind are entering in or arising, and so that you can apply right effort and so on, but generally cultivating mindfulness, practicing mindfulness, knowing what the body is doing, knowing what the mind is doing. And then the last stage is called right concentration. And according to the traditional text, right concentration appears to mean attaining what are called the four jhanas, practicing concentration. One attains the four levels of absorbed meditation. And that may be true, but problem is those are difficult to attain, especially for lay people. Because it requires almost total seclusion from all distraction for long periods of time to really be able to attain or master what are called the four absorptions and the four jhanas. So there's another way of looking at right concentration. Actually, the effect of concentration means non-wavering of the mind. It means calmness of mind, non-wavering, stability. That's the sort of the qualities of a concentrated mind. You practice concentration, not for the sake of just concentration, but for the sake of attaining calmness, stability of mind, non-wavering, and so on. So that you could see that right concentration could mean simply being concentrated on the Dhamma, being concentrated in your life, not being distracted by meaningless, useless things, and having a calm state of mind, being relaxed, calm, and focused on what one is doing. Being focused on all the other aspects of the Eightfold Path, being focused in the practice of mindfulness, the right effort, and the sila, having that sort of that light at the end of the tunnel kind of thing, just in the back of your mind, and being focused on achieving that. You say that could be an idea of right concentration, especially for like the lay person who may not be able to sit down and go into deep samadhi all the time. But these are just perhaps some different ways of looking at it, because otherwise that would leave out a lot of people if it meant attaining the fourth jhana. There's a lot of people who may not be able to reach that level. Anyway, so those are briefly, those are the eight factors of the Eightfold Path. And they're said to be like a wheel. It's depicted as a Dharma wheel, the wheel of Dharma. The Buddha preached the wheel of Dharma, the Eightfold Path, at Sarnath on his first sermon. was depicted as a wheel, because a wheel, the spokes of a wheel, the eight factors are like spokes of a wheel, and each spoke has to be strong, otherwise the wheel will wobble. So it's not a matter of you start with right understanding and then some weeks or months later you start on right thought and then like that and go down the line to the end. But you kind of start practicing them basically all together. But now there's three of those. Three of those factors are the most important. Three out of those eight are considered the real linchpins. Does anyone have an idea what those three might be? Well, at least in my formulation, no. That's right. Right understanding.
Right effort.
Mindfulness. Yeah, those three. Right understanding, right mindfulness, and right effort. And we'll go through those and see why. See how they work in that order. Well, as we already saw, right understanding, you can't do anything without right understanding. Who's going to practice right thought or right speech or right action without right understanding? Why should we go to all that effort? It's easier just to, you know, drink and carouse and do whatever you want. Abuse people and use vile speech. You know, it's work to try to restrain that. So, you know, if there's no reason to, who's going to do that? So, anyway, right understanding, it knows wrong understanding as being wrong, and it understands right understanding as being right. In other words, some people may preach, there's no effect of your actions, and there's no this life or no next life. But right understanding says, yes, there is effect of action. There is karma. There is this life, next life. So if an idea, somebody tries to, you know, tell you that there's no effect of your actions and you can just eat and drink and be merry and do anything you want and nothing's going to happen, when you die there's no result, you know, you're not going to suffer anything from it. You see, according to the Dharma, that's wrong understanding. So that kind of idea comes into your mind, your right understanding will say, ah, that's wrong. And it understands right understanding is right. So mindfully, you see this wrong understanding arising with mindfulness, and you apply the right effort to get rid of it. And the right effort to cultivate the right understanding. And the same for right thought. Let's say you start having greedy thoughts to amass wealth and just to sensory indulge in anything. So right understanding would say, ah, this is wrong thinking. Or if you're thinking about harming somebody. Then you have to have the mindfulness to see that is wrong thought. Well, the mindfulness isolates the thought, the right understanding sees it as wrong thought, and then you cultivate the effort to let go of that thought, and you cultivate the effort to cultivate the opposite thought. So if it's thought of ill will, you cultivate the effort to practice loving kindness at that moment. Or if it's a thought of greed or attachment to something, you cultivate the reflection on the pitikul bhavana. That's what Sri Lankans say. Where, you know, you cultivate the perception of impermanence of something else, and then right speech. Right understanding knows wrong speech is wrong. In other words, the idea to tell a lie comes in the mind. And the right understanding says, no, that's wrong. And so you apply the right effort to abandon that desire to tell a lie or slander. And you abandon that and you cultivate, you know, the truthfulness or something else. Or at least you abandon that. And then the same with right action, with the other precepts. Is it the desire to, kill an animal or kill an insect or even just to kill some person or steal something comes into the mind. Right understanding says, no, these things are unwholesome. These are akusala. Mindfully you detect these thoughts coming in your mind. Mindfully you let go of them. You cultivate the right effort to let go. And if appropriate, you cultivate the opposite positive thought. And the same for right livelihood. Right understanding understands wrong livelihood as being wrong. And right livelihood is being right. And it mindfully abandons wrong livelihood and cultivates the effort to abandon the wrong livelihood and cultivate the right livelihood. And even with effort, right understanding knows what that wrong effort is wrong effort and right effort is right effort. It mindfully abandons wrong effort and cultivates the effort to abandon wrong effort. And cultivate the effort to cultivate right effort. And even with mindfulness, right understanding knows wrong mindfulness is being wrong and right mindfulness is being right. And you might say, what is that? What's an example of that? Well, in the mindfulness, you know, in the Satipatthana, four foundations of mindfulness, part of that mindfulness is also the sampajana, or clear understanding. And being mindful that this body is just four elements. And it's not something to crave or be infatuated by. So, let's say you become fascinated by person of the opposite sex. A man sees a beautiful woman, a woman sees a handsome man. And when you're focusing on the outer details, you're looking at their hair, their build, their features, and you're becoming infatuated. That's wrong mindfulness. So right understanding would say, that's wrong mindfulness. What is right mindfulness? Right mindfulness will see that same person and say, underneath that skin, what is there? There's flesh and bones and putrid smells and worms and things like that. Right? Go down to the morgue and look. That's an example of right mindfulness. Because it allows you to abandon whatever unwholesome thoughts would have come about because of that craving or desire for those superficial features, you see. So that's how you apply right mindfulness in daily life. Or you get stuck on some other sensual desire craving for food. You know, if you have this craving for food, you say, well, you know, what is this food? After you put food in the mouth for 2 minutes, if you spit it out, do you want to eat it again? Or after it comes out the backside, what are you going to do? You don't think it's a beautiful thing. So therefore, even on a craving and attachment to food, you can break the food down and see its elemental qualities. That it's also just the four elements. It's nothing. It's only this craving for taste and attachment. So, you know, the right mindfulness would... Essentially, right mindfulness means it breaks everything down and sees everything as simply just nama rupa, or the four elements, or the five skandhas. Any one of these sort of dhammic analysis, you see, in order for one's attachment to let go of the attachment. So that is what right mindfulness is, an aspect of right mindfulness. So you try to see everything in terms of right mindfulness, because then you're not going to develop passionate craving and desire, because you see that it just leads to suffering. It's delusion. So that's how you would abandon wrong mindfulness, by seeing everything as just being permanent, desirable, and has a self nature. Essentially, those three characteristics. That's what wrong mindfulness sees everything as being permanent, eternal, beautiful, desirable, and me. Right mindfulness sees everything as anicca, dukkha, and anatta. See, so whenever you're seeing something or doing something and deluded by this taking it as permanent, desirable, then you better make the effort to abandon the wrong mindfulness and cultivate the right mindfulness. Even like when you're meditating, you say, oh, I got a pain in my knee. Oh, that's wrong mindfulness. What is right mindfulness? Right mindfulness would say, ah, there's a sensation here. It's a painful sensation, but it's not my knee, it's only a sensation. I'm creating the idea of my knee through clinging and craving and attachment. Or you say that sensation is just made up of heat and vibration. Or that's the fire element and the earth elements rubbing together. Because if you say knee, then the knee belongs to this body, and this body belongs to me. Because that's how the mind put it together. Or a sound, you hear a sound. When somebody's coughing, and you say, oh, that person's coughing, they have a cold, I'm going to get, you know, germs, you know, and, you know, why don't they go outside, or, you know, all kind of negative thoughts. That's wrong mindfulness. Right mindfulness would say, ah, sounds arising and passing away. That's all. Right mindfulness wouldn't identify that sound as being coming from that person and then building up all kind of histories and thoughts based on it. It would simply be aware of hearing, hearing, or smelling, smelling, or feeling, feeling. It doesn't go in on building histories. Essentially, I mean, ultimately, the most powerful form of right mindfulness, in the deepest sense of wisdom, that's what right mindfulness does. So, you know, I'm just trying to give some examples of really how you apply these things, because, you know, this is just not some philosophy. I mean, this is something you do every moment. The Eightfold Path is, you know, something that you're doing every moment, ideally. Anyway, so And then wrong concentration. Right understanding knows right concentration is right and wrong concentration is wrong. What is wrong concentration? Well, you could see that as being wrong concentration. Let's say, you know, like a animals, a cat has concentration. If you concentrate on a mouse, you know, you stare at it and watch all of its, you know, really not be distracted, you know. A lot of things going on in the cat, you know, he's just fully focused on that mouse. But the intent, what's the intent? To jump on it. To kill it. Maybe, or at least to play with it. Thief could be concentrated on trying to pick a lock. That's concentration. Not being distracted. Samadhi and the Panyaku. In the threefold classification of Sila, Samadhi, and Panya. Effort and mindfulness belong to the Samadhi group, the concentration category. And right understanding belongs to the Panya group. Or in this Sri Lanka, you know, you have the Dana, Sila, Bhavana, right? All three of those belong to the Bhavana group. Because Bhavana includes the wisdom. So all three of those belong to the Bhavana group. But most people say, no, let's do Dana and Sila first. And put the Bhavana off. How can you do that? When Bhavana is there, without the Bhavana, you can't do the others. So this is how sometimes our Dhamma gets twisted upside down. And why sometimes the practice of Dhamma isn't effective, because people don't have the right priorities and understanding of it. Or at least they might just be taking the slow road, which is all right. If they, you know, if they want. But anyway, the practice of Dhamma, can each person can mold it or use it, you know, to for any sort of end they want, really, or to mold it to suit their own abilities. Or needs at the time, and basically that what people do. Anyway, that is how, you know, one integrates the Eightfold Path into life. So you can see that really the Eightfold Path is meditation. If you're talking in terms of, you've got to have right understanding, right mindfulness, and right effort in order to do anything according to Dhamma. So that means meditation. So even the Eightfold Path is meditation. So one's whole life is meditation. This idea of, I practice meditation for 20 minutes. Again, this is another kind of misconception. I mean, you know, it is, you know, you might practice meditation for 20 minutes, but when you hold that kind of an idea, you distort the true picture of the Dhamma. That the rest of your day isn't meditation. So, like to leave you with those with that for your reflection, and I see that there's been some other questions put in this bowl. And, you know. I'm just going to answer them kind of fairly quickly, because otherwise I didn't want to get delayed too much longer. Different realms, do they really exist, or is it a condition of mind? Well, Dhammapada says all things proceed from the mind. Mind is the master, mind is the maker. So virtually all realms are created by the mind. Even this human earth is a creation of the mind. As we just mentioned in that one example of the body. When you feel the body, all you're feeling is sensation. The mind creates this idea of a body in a certain shape and destiny and a certain sex and you know, with a name and history. That's all created by the mind. So essentially all realms are created by the mind. Doesn't mean they don't exist, but it means they're still created by the mind. Everything exists as vibration. An example that I like to give about how the elusive nature of matter is just a vibration. You sometimes watch CNN news or some other news on the TV or programs. Well, what happens when you're announcing the news? If you look up in the sky, can you see the broadcaster flying through the sky into your television set? Huh? No. But something is coming through there, isn't it? But what is it? Invisible vibrations or something? Isn't it? I don't know. But yet it goes through the circuits of a TV set and it appears to be some real image there. And we take it to be real, when actually it has no reality. What was it going from the transmitting station to your house? Invisible energy. But it appears on the screen as images. So the same way. All you are invisible energy striking the retina of my eye, but my eye does the same take and creates these images on there. And that's what I'm seeing. The same way as you see these invisible vibrations that are traveling through space, and the TV set is constructed in the same way as our nervous system and the retina of our eye. That is what is meant by all these things are created in our mind. And the vibrations have to exist, they're needed, but you know, they're just invisible energy, they're just atoms, they're just invisible energy. All matter, Einstein even said, all matter is just condensed energy, right? And when I speed it up in vibration, it disappears. Like the rotor of an airplane blade. If you just look at it when it's just sitting there, you see the four or five blades of the propeller. When the airplane starts its engine and starts turning real fast, the blades disappear, don't they? They're the same way. Because matter is in a very slow rate of vibration. When it speeds it up, it disappears. Anyway, I didn't want to get all into that. But, may raise more puzzling questions for you. What is samsara? Is nirvana part of samsara?
These are philosophical questions. You probably heard in Zen or some other Buddhist school they say, Nirvana is Sansara, and Sansara is Nirvana. In a sense, that's true. The Buddha's mind was in Nirvana, but still, he was on this earth and could see Sansara going above. Sansara or Nirvana is simply a state of mind. If the mind has ignorance, you'll have Sansara. If the mind is grounded in wisdom, you'll have Nirvana. So in a sense, the two kind of exist simultaneously, because it's just a matter of what viewpoint you're taking. Because, you just be ordinary, and then if you have the ability to just sit down and go into the formless jhanas, kind of just in a few minutes, then essentially you'd be out of this normal samsara. It was just a state of mind. You just switch channels, like switching a channel on a TV set. So they kind of exist. They exist all simultaneously in the same thing, but yet because of the mind, you could see them separately. For an ordinary worldling, this world is samsara, but for the Buddha, it was nirvana. Or for the other arhats. I'm not going to go into some of these questions that take too long. As we found your yoga exercise very valuable, I recommend a good book on yoga exercises. Well, there's many books written on yoga, and the yoga I learned was from an ashram in South India, and that yoga teacher wrote some books, but they're not available here in the Western countries. They're only sold in this ashram in India. And there's plenty of yoga books, sold here, and I suppose all of them would, have something useful in them, and so on, but I couldn't really recommend any specific ones at the moment. But more than all those yoga exercises, I really encourage you to develop that three-part rhythmic breathing. Develop it where you'd be able to have one in-breath, at least 12 seconds long, breathing 4 seconds in each of the three lobes, and holding the breath in for 5 or 6 seconds, taking 12 seconds to breathe out, and being able to sustain that for 5 or 10 minutes at a time, that kind of breathing without strain or anything. That would be one of the most beneficial things you could probably do. Of course, you can join that with sort of exercises. Like yesterday, the speed in which I was doing those exercises the last couple of days, those movement ones, was kind of ideally in an 8-by-4 ratio. It means take 8 seconds to go into the movement, hold it for about 4 seconds, take 8 seconds to go back to the starting point. I was kind of doing it a little bit fast because I knew you all probably couldn't keep up, so I was probably doing a 6-second movement. But some of you probably just finished your breath after 2 seconds and then, you know, the movement. So it's, and, but even with that, some of you felt something. So you can imagine if you did it, if you're able to do it in the full way, able to coordinate the breath with the movement so that your breath was 8 seconds long, exactly with the movement, starting exactly with the movement and stopping with the movement. And you know, same on the return and everything. Then you the effect of that increases dramatically. So it's just a matter of perfecting. A lot of people think they want more and more and more. You don't need a lot. You have to simply perfect a few things. That's all you really need, rather than just wanting to go on learning more and more and more, not perfecting any of them. Because that's just the nature of our accumulative mind. It just wants more and more and more and more and more without perfecting them. And it thinks more is better, but it's not necessary. Okay, to finish the retreat, we might, for those who like, we might do a little chanting, Pali chanting, and also the five precepts. You took 8 precepts on Friday night, so it's traditional that because you're all going back home, the lay life and all, that we give you the 5 precepts again. So here you can pass. Somebody was good enough to type these up or copy them from a book. So those who don't know them, if you'd like to read along the Pali and the English meaning, or you probably take one of those, take it home if you want it. Start where it says by the 3 refuges and the 5 precepts. Namaskar. Dhammang saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi buddhaṃ saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammaṃ saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi buddhaṃ saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammaṃ saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Anātipātā viramani sikāpadaṃ samādhiyāmi. Adinadana Veramani Sikapadang Samadhyami. Kame Sumichachara Veramani Sikapadang Samadhyami. Musavada Veramani Sikapadang Samadhyami. Suramirya Majjhapamadatana Veramani Sikapadang Samadhyami. By morality they gain with rebirth, by morality they attain wealth, by morality they achieve long life, therefore purify morality. Okay, is there any more of you chanting on that? Anyway, for those who know just the Vandana, the Sikipiso, Svakato, Supatipano, and a few of those other gathas, you can just sort of follow me in the chanting. But I chant a little bit slower than normally the Sri Lankans are used to, so try to not to go so fast.
Kusalina yant tam santam padam abhisame ca sakho ju ca su ju ca suvacho ca samunu anatimani santu sakho ca sumbaro ca apake ca ca salavuka utti santindriyo ca nipako ca Chakundam samachare kinchina vinyu pare upavale om sukino va kemino hantu sambe satta bhavandu sukitatta ye kechipana bu patita savata varavana vasesa Digavai mahantava manjimarasa kanukatula dittavai eva Chandure vasande avidure mbutava sambhavesiva sambe satta bhavanta sukitata Naparo param nikumbeta nati manyeta katachinam kanchi Yaro sanya patika sanya nanya manyasa dukkam icheya Mata yatane amputtam ayusayeka putam anurake Devam bisambam bhutesu manasambhavaye aparimanam Mettam ca sambhalokasmim manasambhavaye aparimanam Undam adocha tiriyancha asambhadam avidam asapattam Tittang charang nasino vasayano va yavatasavagatamindo etting satting aditya brahma mittang viharang idamahu ditting cha anupagama silava dasanina sampano Kame suvineyam ginnam nai jatam gambaseyam unaretiti Etena sanjavanjena sotite hotu sambandha Etena sanjavanjena sotite hotu sambandha Te hotu sambhana akasata chambhumata devanaga mahindika punyanta anumonditva chirang rakkandudhi sanang akasata chambhumata devanaga mahindika Yantam anumonditva chirang rakkantu Akasata jambumata devanagama indika Punyantam anumonditva chirang rakkantu mangparam Itavata chami sampatam Sampadam Sambe Devanumodantu Sambha Sampati Sindhya Etavatacha Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sambe Bhutanumodantu Sambha Sampati Sindhya Etavatacha sambalam sambe danumodantu sambha sampati sindhya imina punya kamina mame pala samagamo satan samagamo yava nimbana patya kayena vacha chittena amadena maya katam acchayam kamami bante bhure panya tathagata kayena vacha amadena maya katam acchayam kamami dhamma sandhittika akalika kayena Kamami gosa patipanna anuttara